All right. Good morning, listeners. Welcome to Thursday in the Doghouse. I'm your host, Rini Premeza, the Jersey Dog Trainer. I'm very excited to have as my guest today Dr. Nicholas Dodman. In 1981, Dr. Dodman immigrated to the United States, where he became a faculty member of Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine. Shortly after his arrival, Dr. Dodman became interested in behavioral pharmacology and the field of animal behavior. After spending several years in this area of research, he founded the Animal Behavior Clinic, one of the first of its kind, at Tufts in 1986. He received an additional board certification in animal behavior from the American College of Veterinary Behaviorists. Dr. Dodman has written four acclaimed best-selling books. His first book, The Dog Who Loved Too Much, was an unqualified success, selling more than 100,000 copies, as did his second book, The Cat Who Cried for Help. His third book, Dogs Behaving Badly, was again a bestseller, while his latest, The Well-Adjusted Dog, has just been released as a trade paperback. Our discussion today will center around dogs that suffer from obsessive-compulsive disorders. If you're interested in this subject, I can personally recommend that you read Dr. Dodman's book, The Dog Who Loved Too Much, in which he devotes quite a large chapter. Before we talk to Dr. Dodman, please let me tell you what services I offer as a professional dog trainer in the South Jersey area. Is your dog always in the doghouse? Does he greet people by jumping all over them? Does she chew your shoes and steal your undies? Guess what? Your dog needs training. Hi, I'm Rini Premeza, the Jersey Dog Trainer, and I train dogs using only positive-based methods. My services include private training right in your own home. I also offer group puppy kindergarten classes starting at 8 weeks of age and group classes for adolescent and adult dogs beginning at 5 months of age. All group classes are held at Dog Days Camp for Canines, 23 West Main Street, Marlton, New Jersey. For more information, please contact me at 609-280-9338. We're on the web at www.jerseydogtrainer.com. Again, that's 609-280-9338. We're on the web at www.jerseydogtrainer.com. Good morning, Dr. Dodman. Welcome to the Doghouse.
Good morning.
I'm very excited to be talking to you this morning about dogs that suffer from obsessive-compulsive disorders, and I have a lot of questions for you.
All right.
So what are some activities that dogs do that would be classified as obsessive-compulsive behaviors?
I think it's best if I explain it like this, that, you know, first of all, an obsessive-compulsive disorder, and we shouldn't really use the word obsessive with dogs because we can't prove they obsess, but say a canine compulsive disorder, which I think is an obsessive compulsive disorder, like in the human equivalent, is actually a normal behavior that a dog displays, but instead of displaying it at the right time and to the right degree, he expresses it compulsively, continuously, kind of mindlessly, no obvious purpose, and sometimes to his physical detriment and certainly to the detriment of his relationship with his owners. So if you look at any of the natural behaviors that dogs do, like grooming, eating, walking around, predatory behavior, you know, chasing things down, any of these behaviors can be expressed as compulsive disorders under the right circumstances.
Okay. Well, you said under the right circumstances. So what role would the environment play in this type of situation?
Yeah, the environment factors in. So these behaviors are actually a combination. They're caused by a combination of factors, some of them genetic, and that's what our latest research found was the genetic factor. And then some kind of environmental stress or stressor. So, you know, it can go this way, that if you have a dog who's predisposed, whose environment is perfect, he may never express the behavior. If you get a dog who doesn't have the problem and he's stressed, he won't display the behavior either. Mm-hmm. So you really need to have the genetic predisposition and then be put into, as it were, the pressure cooker of life and be expressed, subjected to stresses that is difficult for the dog to cope with.
Mm-hmm. What do you see as a veterinary behaviorist when you are taking clients and seeing and assessing their dogs? What are the most common OCD behaviors that you see in your office?
Well, the classical one, the one that was first described as a compulsive disorder by Dr. Judith Rappaport from National Institute of Mental Health. She's a human child psychiatrist, and the fact that dogs, quotes, wash their hands was brought to her attention following the publication of her bestseller book, The Boy Who Could Not Stop Washing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that she did a study on the dogs and said this is a compulsive disorder that the dogs are displaying. So some people call this compulsive licking of wrists or hocks. They call it lick granuloma. Other people call it acral lick dermatitis, but it's one and the same thing. So that's very common in larger breeds, over 50 pounds, like Goldens and Labs and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Then you see tail chasing is pretty common, especially in Bull Terriers and German Shepherds. And then you see snapping at imaginary flies or invisible flies, imaginary flies, by various little terriers like Norfolk and Norwich and so on, which mm-hmm. are almost the same dog. And sometimes you can see compulsive rock eating. You can see compulsive digging. I've seen compulsive swimming. So there's all kinds of bizarrities, but most commonly related to predation, chasing things, usually a tail, but it can be lights and shadows, things that move, not just as a fun thing, to sort of the exclusion of regular life. So it's a qualitative definition. We know that all dogs may do some of these things, but when they do it over a certain frequency, then it becomes a problem.
Right. You know, it's interesting. Just last night, I was watching, I don't know if you ever watch this, it's the America's Funniest Videos.
I do watch that sometimes.
And last night, they I saw this once before. They had I believe the dog was a golden retriever, laying on the couch with a beef marrow bone. And he would bring his hind foot up as if you think he was going to scratch his ear. But as his hind foot approached his mouth, he would then show his teeth and snarl at his hind foot because he was guarding the bone from his foot.
Yeah, I've seen that video. And in fact, I don't believe that is an OCD.
Really?
What that is called floating limb syndrome.
Oh,
what happens is if an animal, in particular a monkey, where this was first noted, if a monkey is raised in isolation so that it's unable to kind of perform rough and tumble play with other monkeys, biologically it needs to do this rough and tumble. It needs to have an adversary.
Mm-hmm.
When there's no adversary around, oftentimes the monkey's back leg becomes the enemy. And they have this battle with their back leg. It floats over their shoulder. Then they see it and they get very angry with it and have a kind of dominance, subordinates type wrestle with their foot, which of course is a battle you can't win.
Really?
And this dog was doing the same thing. So I'd bet you, you know, far from being a funny video, that this is a very sad story of
right.
a dog who was raised in splendid isolation, had no opportunity to
right.
play, and ended up with his dominant struggle with his foot over a bone.
Oh, my goodness. Well, geez, that's fascinating to me. And I know that there was a very sad component to the video, which is that people are clueless and they think stuff like this is very funny when, in fact, it's not. So you mentioned that there are certain breeds that are prone to this. What do you suppose causes this to be a genetic component? Can you explain that? Why would German Shepherds tend to chase their tails? Why would Bull Terriers tend to do this? What is it about the breeds themselves?
Well, the genetic glitch, I think, is that kind of the brake is taken off. So normally we have behaviors that are sort of encoded, typically in an area of the brain called basal ganglia.
Okay.
So these behaviors are sort of freewheeling down there waiting to be accessed when, not really the behaviors, but the mechanism is down there to be accessed as and when needed. But if you take the break off, then the behavior is suddenly expressed with no control on it. It's not not expressed appropriately. It's just going off at random.
Mm-hmm.
But when that happens, which behavior sort of pops out of the Pandora's box of encoded behaviors depends on what is that the breed's particular penchant. So if you take dogs like terriers who are bred to chase small varmints, oftentimes the manifestation is that of, you know, snapping or chasing or trying to catch lights, because there are no rabbits, there are no rats, so they kind of go off half-cocked with, you know, they're all dressed up and they've got no place to go.
Oh, my.
And if you take a herding breed,
yes.
Like a collie, that is derived from predatory behavior, the herding behavior, and so they will get involved in what's called the appetitive phase of predatory behavior, and they will go searching and looking and sometimes pouncing on lights and shadows.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a dog that, you know, where grooming is a major factor, you will find these grooming compulsions like, you know, the Goldens with the nice curly golden hair. You know, they'll lick and groom themselves compulsively.
Mm-hmm.
If you get it just goes on and on. It's just whatever the dog was bred for. It's got to the point with me now that if somebody invented a brand new breed and they said, you know, here's a South American pogo, I would say, what was the dog bred for? And they'd say, well, he was bred for digging holes and climbing trees. Then that's exactly the behavior that would be expressed compulsively in the gene.
Okay. And so this is all part of the DNA factor. This is just there waiting to show itself, given
the
right set of circumstances.
You know, the tendency, we know that, for example, border collies will herd.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes inappropriately, they'll herd people and children running in groups, and mm-hmm. you know, they kind of got to herd. Sometimes they will, you know, they need everybody to be in bed before they will retire because they want their flock to be asleep.
Yes.
So they have all these things, and this is a kind of herding dog thing. The reason, you know, that bull terriers and German shepherds chase their tails is because they have very high prey drive. So bull terriers were bred for varmint killing. And German shepherds were bred for herding, which is derived from predatory, so they chase their tail. So everyone's doing what it is that they were most powerfully selected by us to do in the past when the breed was created.
Mm-hmm. This is fascinating.
That answers the question.
Yes. So there's a genetic component and there is an environmental component. So when you see dogs like this in your practice, are these dogs living in environments that could be unhealthy for them to bring out this behavior? In other words, possibly living where the dog is crated too many hours a day, or the dog is not given near enough exercise, or are there other factors that you can identify for us?
Well, that's exactly right, Rini, that something bad happens, and I believe that it may be being crated for inordinately long periods of time, which seems to be, for example, part of the bull terrier culture. A lot of bull terriers seem to spend hours and hours, especially in earlier critical periods of their life, mm-hmm. confined to crates for one reason or another.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whether you're a bull terrier confined to a crate or a German shepherd who's kept in a wire pen,
mm-hmm.
When you're in that position and have no way of expressing your natural behaviors, first of all, you start to do what's called a displacement behavior. You engage in a displacement behavior, which for a bull terrier, he might catch sight of the tip of his tail out of the corner of his eye. And he just lopes towards it, and it, of course, disappears as he moves towards it. It goes away, so it becomes something he can chase. Or if you're a German shepherd inside an enclosure, you might pace 5 paces to the right, and then you pace back 5 paces to the left, and mm-hmm. then 5 paces to the right. If you catch it in the very early stages when it's just, you know, like a boredom displacement type behavior, and you recorrect the environment, you can catch it in the early stages before it develops. But once the dog has done it for such a long time, for hours and hours on end, those pathways in the brain become well-worn. So you can now take the animal out of the situation where it was stressed initially and you can put it in a field, and it'll still do the behavior because now it's got ingrained, hardwired, and it's sort of like the, like I was saying earlier on, the brakes off and the behavior just continues to, you know, sort of, you know, express itself over and over again. Now that's what, when you call it a compulsive disorder.
Okay. All right. So let's take that dog, for example, that you're talking about. Let's say, for example, he had the perfect situation to express this behavior. And let's say somebody bred that dog. That dog can determine or have a direct effect on the genes of his offspring because he's expressed that behavior. Is my theory correct?
Yeah. So what it is that, you know, if you take a bunch of, say, bull terriers or Dobermans, you know, let's say, I don't know this number, but just let's say the number of them with the affected gene is 20%.
Mm-hmm.
Or let's say 10% might be more realistic. And then you put them in the pressure cooker of life. Those 10 out of those 100 will express the behavior, whereas the other 90% don't. So, but if you then take the 10% who have the gene, because by displaying the behavior, they've shown that they have it, and then you breed two of those together, you'll have a much greater chance of having a compulsive disorder in the offspring.
Mm-hmm.
So we've actually looked at this. So we've got a 200-strong pedigree or genealogy, they call it, like a family tree of bull terriers.
Right.
And you can actually follow the behavior down the line, and you can see when you breed affected to affected, you end up with, you know, 5 out of 6 of a litter affected.
Mm-hmm. Jeez. You know, I know you're not a medical doctor as far as for humans and everything, but it kind of makes sense to me that this would happen in humans also. That they would suffer through some environmental things that are not, you know, in other words, something's lacking in a person's environment to cause their OCD, and then they then pass it off to any offspring that they have.
Well, that's right. I mean, some people have the gene, but all of us these days, me included, are expressed to, we're subjected to life pressures that didn't exist. You know, mm-hmm. when we were sort of living more like the center, you know, like the center of the country on farms and growing corn and driving tractors and being human beings and being out there in the wild, you know, in with nature, this was much less common. But as the human population has condensed itself into sort of urban aggregates, people are walking in the concrete jungle, as Desmond Morris used to say, and they're doing things that really are not satisfying biological drives that we were designed to operate. So, for example, one man with obsessive compulsive disorder that I talked to in a clinic at Harvard Medical School, I was invited in to see the consultation, actually several consultations, mm-hmm. and the man was a compulsive hair puller, beard puller, as a matter of fact. And when he was sitting in front of the flickering screen and living in the concrete jungle, he was pulling his beard. So it came to the end of the interview, and I said to the psychiatrist, the psychiatrist said to me, do you want to ask this man any questions? And I said, yes, may I ask you, did it ever stop? And the man said, yes, it did, actually. It stopped one time when I went hitchhiking across Canada. And for the entire time I was hitchhiking, I never pulled my beard once. And then I got back to the Harvard Extension Program and immediately started to pull my beard again.
Mm-hmm.
But when you think about it, when this man was hitchhiking, he was expressing human sort of basic biological behavior. He was out there. He was had real concerns about real personal safety. He had to figure out a place to sleep. He had to make a fire. He had to try and hitch rides. You know, he had to watch out for the weather.
Mm-hmm.
He was doing all these natural things for a person. Mm-hmm. And then he goes back and he's eating fast food, driving around in the car and sitting in front of a computer. That is not natural.
I see. This is really interesting. So what type of treatments are available for all of these dogs who suffer from OCD?
Well, if you start with the human animal, I mean, in human animal, they have cognitive therapy, and drug treatment is basically all that's available. We don't have the ability to do cognitive therapy with animals because you can sit a dog that's compulsively chasing his tail on a couch, and you can explain to him the error of his ways, and he won't listen. So we're unable to do talk therapy. We're unable to really do sort of exposure therapy and all these things that work in humans. So we're stuck with two things. So instead of cognitive therapy, we do environmental enrichment. We try and make sure that the dog has the most wonderful life both inside and outside the house.
Mm-hmm.
And we teach people how to enrich the indoor environment to make it more dog-friendly or cat-friendly if we're dealing with a cat OCD, or horse-friendly if we're dealing with an equine OCD. We also try and engage the animal, let's say dog, in an activity that is more what his particular breed was bred to do.
Mm-hmm.
So ideally, you know, if you had a herding breed who was doing something to do with herding along the lines of OCD, we'd actually see if they could get enrolled in a real herding class,
mm-hmm.
or perhaps do some field trial work, or agility even,
mm-hmm.
To try and do something that is along the lines of what the dog would normally do. For, you know, a Chesapeake Bay, we might have them do something in the way of swimming and retrieving and doing things that are much better for, we're more like what the dog would normally do. Having said that, if we have everything arranged properly inside the house and outside the house, while we remove the stress, so that it won't happen again, we hope, you still have this continuous pathway that's been activated. And to stop that, we have to sort of throw a wrench in the works, and the wrench is medicine. So the two medicines that work are either the human anti-obsessional medications, which are really basically drugs like Prozac, or a new discovery that we made and patented here at Tufts, which has been shown to work in several different animal species, and also the human animal recently in 2010, February. We published an article about use of drugs that block glutamate, so-called NMDA receptor blockers.
Okay.
Glutamate is one of the main excitatory neurotransmitter systems in the brain, along with norepinephrine. And if you not turn it off, but mute it, activate it so much,
mm-hmm.
you can see a tremendous improvement in about 50% of dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And the beauty of it is that it works in synergy with the human anti-obsessional medicine. So if you have both of these, you can use them together. And in this case, 1 + 1 = 3. So they're synergistic. They're not merely additive, and they certainly are not antagonistic.
Mm-hmm.
So there's more hope for people and dogs, thanks to work that started here in the early 2000s and has been published just recently, February 2010, in a journal called Clinical Psychopharmacology.
So when I was reading the book, The Dog Who Loved Too Much, and I was reading about your work with the Bull Terriers, from what it sounded like, this was not new to you per se, but you were kind of discovering at that time how much this breed was prone to chasing its tail. From what it sounded like, is that you have done a lot of research on Bull Terriers.
Oh, yeah. And for me, the Bull Terrier, I mean, I don't mean to pick on Bull Terriers. I'm just, you know, very interested in that
breed.
Right. And that work started probably sometime around 1985. And I remember the day it started because I was doing some training with a trainer. There was a fairly well-known trainer and myself, mm-hmm. both training a bunch of owners how to train their dogs out on the Tufts field.
Uh-huh.
And one of them said, I have a Bull Terrier, and I don't know if you know anything about this, but it's chasing its tail. And it's a one-year-old white neutered male Bull Terrier.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, no, actually, you know what? I said, there's a publication that I just read on my desk. It's a case report of a tail-chasing dog. Let's go up after the training class and take a look at it. So I went up to my room afterwards, and there was the paper lying on my desk, and I looked at it, and then suddenly it went, oh, my God, it was a one-year-old neutered male white Bull Terrier that was being described in the paper.
How about that?
I said, this is cookie cutter. These two dogs are exactly the same, and therefore there's probably a genetic basis.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my sort of, sort of eureka moment.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I started collecting Bull Terrier samples and actually got to the point where I had a number of blood samples collected for DNA analysis. And I had a geneticist at that time at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden,
right.
who said he would analyze them.
Uh-huh.
And I put them in the mail, and all the glass tubes broke.
Oh, no.
So I learned don't ship blood in glass tubes, ship it in plastic tubes.
Oh, my God.
And then I picked myself up, dusted myself off, and I got a grant from NIH to hire Dr. Alice Moon, who's a behavioral geneticist.
Yes,
and I could only afford her half-time.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, look, this bull terrier work is getting too much for me, you know, so can you please collect the samples for me and put, you know, put it on an Excel spreadsheet, and
mm-hmm.
we'll get blood and put them in the bank. And, you know, so that work kind of started there, my partnership with Dr. Moon, and we went forward. And then in the early 2000s, we met Dr. Edward Ginns, who's been a powerhouse. He's at the University of Massachusetts and
mm-hmm.
is a very eminent human molecular geneticist and actually neurologist.
Mm-hmm.
And he really supported our work, not financially, but morally. He said, you know, you guys are on the right track. And so we redoubled our efforts, and that's when we collected all these DNA samples. We were waiting for the technology to analyze them
mm-hmm.
to catch up with us, and it did in about 2007.
Mm-hmm.
So we sent the samples, just basically work for hire, to the Broad Institute in Massachusetts, said, run these on your so-called SNP chip.
Mm-hmm.
And they ran it, and lo and behold, when it was analyzed statistically, it turns out that we had a major hit on chromosome 7. And that work was published in January 2010 in one of the Nature series of journals called Molecular Psychiatry.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to get it in real fast because we know this is a very competitive field. So we put it in as a letter. And apparently that publication has been either first or second most widely cited article since the beginning of to 2010.
Mm-hmm.
So people are paying a lot of attention. I talked to a molecular geneticist who's interested in OCD from Toronto. He said that our work has completely shaken up the world of human OCD research, and everybody's completely changed direction because of this work.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And we've got the same gene is now being looked at because Dr. Ginns and myself flew down to NIH, and they're currently sequencing the gene in humans,
mm-hmm.
both affected and controlled. So if that came to pass, that our discovery in the Dobermans translates into what's causing the problem in the humans,
mm-hmm.
then we would have been part of a team, leaders in the team, who made the discovery of, quote, the first psychiatric gene.
Jeez. That's wonderful. That's just wonderful. And what a great accomplishment for you, not just with the dog world, but in the human world also. So
I've always thought, you know, my whole concept, which was actually shared by one of the Tufts University presidents, the late Jean Mayer, he said that he believed there was only one medicine, that basically whether it was human medicine, which is the human animal, or whether it was dog or cat or horse, the veterinary animal,
mm-hmm.
or whether it was dental medicine or veterinary dental medicine, that basically we were all dealing with mammalian species, and, you know, there were huge similarities which were greater than any of the differences. So that's always been my premise, and it was good to have a president who felt the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I've always worked with various other university schools.
Mm-hmm.
I've spent a lot of time working with the medical school with my good colleague, Dr. Lewis Schuster, who's been my right hand ever since the early 80s, and a tremendous guy and a wonderful advisor and friend and
mm-hmm.
collaborator. And I've worked with the Department of Psychology at the main Tufts University at Medford, and more recently we've been working with University of Massachusetts and Broad Institute, and now just as of a few months ago with the National Institute of Health. And, you know, all these people come together, so it's like a collaborative effort
mm-hmm.
in going forward. And we're currently looking at other dog breeds, some different breeds that have tail chasing and some completely different breeds that have different OCDs,
mm-hmm.
as well as looking for the human gene and as well as sequencing the gene. So this has become, you know, as I thought it would 15 years ago, what will be the rest of my academic life will be interested, you know, be involved in looking at this and pursuing it.
I wish I had an hour show, really. So many other questions have developed in my mind, but we don't. And I want you to be able to tell people about your upcoming seminar for both dog owners and professionals in Tinton Falls, New Jersey. When will that be held and where?
Well, I'm looking forward to that tremendously, and I will be talking about OCD. I'll have an hour and a half talk on that, as well as and all the medical treatment as a separate lecture. But the Tinton Falls seminar is on the weekend of the 19th and 20th of June, and it's being held at this terrific establishment called Purr and Pooch, which is a very high-end training and boarding center run by a good friend of mine, Dicky Palazzo.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's thrown his very beautiful facility open to me. I can come down there. I'm going to drive down. It's close enough. And, you know, I'll set up camp there, and I'll deliver talks about dominance aggression, so-called. You know, now it's been reclassified. Fear aggression in dogs, separation anxiety, thunderstorm phobia, compulsive disorders, the well-adjusted dog talk, which is the title of the last book.
Right. I have to. I'm getting a sign from my engineer that we have to stop. Our time is up.
Yeah.
I want to remind everybody that you're coming back next week from 10 to 10:30 on Thursday to discuss phobias in dogs, and I, for one, cannot wait. Well, I want to thank you so much for visiting with us today, and we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, Renee.
Thank you very much. You have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, listeners, for tuning in today. I hope you come back again next week when Dr. Dodman will return to talk to us about phobias in dogs. I will look forward to that, and I hope you will, too. See you then. Have a great week.